To headlines, Iran's leader says a hostile rivalry of world powers and their increasing military threats have made the situation more complicated for other countries. Palestinians attend a funeral for a teenager who was shot dead by Israeli soldiers in the occupied West Bank this morning. And also in our headlines, North Korea fires multiple missiles, including an intercontinental ballistic one, a day after the U.S. president wraps up his Asia tour. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says Iran has firmly stood against hostilities and enmities and continues to make progress despite challenges. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the comments in a meeting with Iranian lawmakers. The leader said the Islamic Republic is being considered as a challenge by world powers because it has dealt a blow to their hegemonic ambitions. Ayatollah Khamenei added that the hostile stance of some world powers and their increasing rivalry, military threats rather, have made the situation more complicated for other countries. Iranians have marked the 40th anniversary of the liberation of the southwestern city of Khorramshahr. The occasion is marked every year as a decisive moment that changed the fate of the 1980s Iran-Iraq war. Yusuf Jalali reports from Khorramshahr.
It's just another day in Iran's southwestern city of Khorramshahr, with a call to prayer resonating from the city's main mosque, Masjid Jame. But 40 years ago, on this day, the mosque was witness to a historic moment that changed the course of the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s. It was the day when the city was recaptured from the Iraqi forces after 19 months. War veteran Abdul Saheb still recalls what he refers to as the decisive day.
The liberation of Khorramshahr was one of the greatest moments for Iran in its war with Iraq. Khorramshahr was a highly strategic city, both geographically and economically, as it was and still is a major port city with oil and gas reserves. Iraq used all its force to occupy the city, but lost to our people's resistance.
Khorramshahr was the first city that was captured by Iraq shortly after the onset of a war that took a marathon 8 years, only to end in a ceasefire, with no gains for Iraq. Then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein enjoyed full military support from the West, believing to capture Khorramshahr only in 3 hours.
Saddam thought in vain that he would be able to take control of Khorramshahr in 3 hours, but the resistance of our brave men and women made it take 45 days to occupy only two-thirds of the city. So Saddam and his Western supporters, with all their advanced weapons, faced our people's steadfastness.
But the strategic port city of Khorramshahr was finally captured by Iraq in October 1980. After an eventful 576 days, the city was liberated in May 1982 during Operation Beit al-Muqaddas, which forced Iraqis to retreat to the border.
During Operation Beit al-Muqaddas, we entirely repulsed Iraqis from Khorramshahr. It was a heavy defeat, not only for Iraq, but for the West, which stood with the aggressors. During the successful operation, we captured up to 19,000 Iraqi troops and a substantial amount of Iraqi military hardware in Khorramshahr.
Once known as the Bride of the Middle East, Khorramshahr today has turned into a symbol of resistance in Iran. While some of the bullet-riddled walls are still kept untouched, everywhere else in the city, there's a sign that reminds passersby of the May 24th resistance.
The liberation of Khorramshahr went down in history as a turning point in the Iran-Iraq war that changed the fate of the war and stopped the Iraqi forces from making further incursions into the Iranian soil. That's why Iranians still remember the decisive moment to honor those who made it happen. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Khorramshahr.
Palestinians hold a funeral for a teenager who was shot dead by Israeli forces near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus earlier in the day. Sayyid 16-year-old Qaith Rafiq Yamin was shot in the head and pronounced dead minutes later. It happened during confrontations that erupted after hundreds of settlers stormed the tomb of Prophet Joseph in Nablus under the protection of the Israeli army. At least 80 Palestinians were also injured during the attacks. Hamas resistance movement has blamed Israel for the escalation of tensions in the West Bank. Separately, the Palestinian authorities urged the international community to break its silence and provide protection to Palestinians, especially children, who are targeted by Israeli gunfire on an almost daily basis. And over a week into the tragic death of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, Israel refuses to accept responsibility for her killing. Another Palestinian reporter who was next to Abu Akleh when she was shot says the regime deliberately targeted her to silence journalists. In an interview with Press TV, Shatha Hanaisha dismissed claims by Israel that the veteran Al Jazeera Arabic journalist might have been hit by Palestinian fire. Hanaisha says Israeli troops killed Abu Akleh to stop media coverage of the regime's crimes. Hanaisha said since Israel seeks to evade accountability, it will not allow an independent investigation into Abu Akleh's killing. She said, "It's a regular thing with Israeli forces to kill Palestinians and get away with it, as nobody bothers to hold them to account." Abu Akleh was killed while covering a raid by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin earlier this month. She's widely believed to be killed by Israeli forces, the Associated Press said Tuesday. Its own investigation supports assertions the bullet that killed her came from an Israeli gun, but the regime says its own investigation has not determined that narrative. Israel says even if that's the case, it does not appear the soldier who fired the gun will stand guilty of criminal misconduct. A Palestinian official says the Israeli atrocities have grown to such an extent that indicate the regime only understands the language of force. According to Gaza's governor, Ibrahim Abu al-Naja, Palestinians will not remain silent and will continue their struggle against the occupying regime. Al-Naja also condemned the regime's expansion of illegal settlements, stressing that Palestinians will not cede a single inch of their territory. He said Israel is working on plans to expel the remaining Palestinians from their territories, but he noted the Palestinian people today are determined to reclaim their land and return to their homes more than ever before. Al-Naja added that Palestinians will not resume the futile negotiations with Israel despite pressure from the outside. Israel has been conducting a violent campaign of aggression against Palestinians in recent months. And the Yemeni army says it has shot down a Saudi drone over the capital, Sana'a. It says the incident is the latest violation of the UN brokered truce, which will expire in a week amid efforts to extend it. Abdul Latif Al Washali reports from Sana'a.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, says the country's air defenses shot down a spy drone operated by Saudi Arabia with a locally made surface-to-air missile. Sariya says the aircraft was carrying out hostile acts in Yemeni airspace in violation of the UN brokered truce, which came into effect on April 2nd and expires in days.
A combat drone belonging to the Saudi-led coalition that was flying over Sana'a was shot down and fell here on the Ruwaishan cross. The Saudi-led coalition continues to violate the truce, and unfortunately the United Nations has not taken any action to protect the truce that it sponsors.
Local media say three civilians were killed and three others were wounded after the drone crashed in a residential area in Sana'a. In the wake of the incident, head of Yemen's negotiating delegation Mohammed Abdus Salam says the Saudi-led coalition is responsible for a possible breakdown of the peace process. The negotiating team says the UN should hold the coalition to account for its actions.
In the face of all these violations and delays in implementing the terms of the armistice, the United Nations must hold the obstructing party that violates the terms of the armistice fully responsible. The United Nations cannot impose the specific sanctions on any of the parties, but it can at least condemn the violations. Therefore, the United Nations must take a positive attitude and condemn any party that violates the armistice that it sponsors.
The two-month truce mandates a nationwide ceasefire. Under the agreement, the coalition must also allow fuel ships to enter the port city of Hodeidah. However, the Saudi-led coalition has repeatedly ignored its obligations. The new violation of the UN brokered truce once more demonstrates how Saudi Arabia is blocking a political solution in Yemen by its repeated breaches. People here demand that the United Nations take action and adopt a clear stance against the infringements by the Saudi-led coalition. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
In other news, North Korea ramps up its missile tests, reportedly firing several short and long-range projectiles in a single day amid heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula. South Korea and Japan say three missiles, including one that appeared to be an ICBM, were fired in the early hours of Wednesday. Seoul and Tokyo have called the launches provocative. South Korea's military says it has, in response, held a joint drill with American forces without giving any details. North Korea has conducted a flurry of missile tests, including its largest ICBM this year. The launches happened just a day after U.S. President Joe Biden wrapped up his Asia trip, during which he agreed to new measures to deter the nuclear-armed North. A White House official says Biden has been briefed on the latest launches. Meanwhile, the South Korean defense chief has, in a phone call with his U.S. counterpart, called for an early deployment of American strategic assets in his country. Our correspondent in Seoul, Frank Smith, explains why exactly North Korea keeps working on its missile technology despite all the denuclearization talk from the U.S. Let's take a listen.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un promised then-president of the United States, Donald Trump, that Pyongyang would refrain from long-range missile testing and nuclear testing so long as the U.S. dropped its hostile policy. Really, the U.S. didn't come forward with any negotiations with North Korea, kept North Korea under United Nations Security Council sanctions. North Korea then sort of gave perhaps the Biden administration a bit of time to come forward, and now with the conservative Yoon Suk-yeol government here in the South, we can see that patience really has kind of run out from the North, with analysts suggesting now North Korea really isn't going to look for any sort of denuclearization talks, but is likely to maintain a nuclear deterrence against what it sees as U.S. aggression.
Afghan health experts are sounding the alarm over the deteriorating health system in their country. They say Afghanistan will soon run out of medicines if urgent actions are not taken. Rahmatullah Balban reports from Kabul.
Rights groups warn that people are dying from lack of medicines in Afghanistan. Afghan Medicine Services Union also says that medicine supplies in the country are running low and that no medicine might be available to the patients within the next 2 months.
Afghanistan is facing an unprecedented drug shortage and a sharp rise in drug prices. These days we are supplying drugs from our stocks and reserves, and I'm afraid they will run out of medicines within the next 2 months. The situation has hit our nation, health sector, and drug sellers.
The union blames the banking crisis, major cuts in global aid, and U.S. sanctions for the medicine shortage. It also called on the Taliban to allow traders to import medicine in any possible way.
Medicine shortage is rooted in different problems. Firstly, most world countries have stopped medicine export to Afghanistan since the Islamic Emirate is not recognized worldwide. Secondly, major amounts of drug importers' money is frozen and banks in New York are not cooperating. Thirdly, the Taliban have imposed certain restrictions on drug imports.
Patients in Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital in Kabul complain about their inability to provide medicines, calling for help from the international community to save their lives.
I am from the Jawzjan province. I have brought my child for treatment in this hospital in Kabul. I have been here for 5 days and I have spent all my money on services and medications. Some medicines are very hard to find and some very expensive. The doctor has given me this prescription and I am wondering how to provide the drugs.
This comes as Afghanistan is facing multiple outbreaks of diseases, including COVID-19, measles, and acute malnutrition. Afghan hospitals and clinics are running out of medicines. Doctors here say urgent action is needed to save the lives of patients. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A Ukrainian lawmaker says Russian forces are seeking to encircle Ukrainian troops in twin eastern cities from three directions in an attempt to control the Donbass region. This, as the war between the two neighbors now drags into its fourth month, Musa Magomedov says Russian forces keep bombing Severodonetsk and Lysychansk in Donetsk and Luhansk provinces in totally inhuman fashion. He says the attacks are causing civilian deaths. Ukraine's military general staff has also said that Russia is using aircraft to support its ground forces. Earlier, President Volodymyr Zelensky warned that Moscow is seeking to destroy the industrial Donbass region, where it has now focused its attacks. The Russian Defense Ministry did not immediately respond to the allegations. On Tuesday, the Russian Defense Minister, however, said that Moscow is deliberately slowing its offensive to allow civilians to evacuate. Russian forces have already taken control of three towns in the Donetsk region, including Svitlodarsk. And the United States has just seen one of its deadliest school shootings in years. A gunman has killed 19 children and two adults at an elementary school in the state of Texas. The suspect has been identified as an 18-year-old man. Texas Governor Greg Abbott says the suspect is also dead, apparently killed by police officers in the town of Uvalde. Reports say the gunman drove up to the school and entered with a rifle and a handgun. The carnage follows a series of mass shootings in the United States this month. Despite recurring mass casualty shootings, multiple initiatives to reform gun regulations have failed in Congress, leading states and local councils to enact their own restrictions. A new report by the FBI revealed that the U.S. experienced 61 active shooter incidents in 2021, showing a sharp rise over 2020 and the highest tally in more than 20 years. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Two men.
Yani.
Thanks.
Bazaar.
The need for home appliances dates back to the early stages of human existence, when cave dwellers began developing tools to preserve and prepare food. Today, home technology has become more sophisticated to match our fast-paced lifestyles. The level of convenience and comfort of home is also determined by these items, and they have even become a status symbol for some. In a sense, home appliances define modern living, changing the means of dealing with food, clothing, cleaning, and so much more.
Hello there, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm Samson Seas, back from the Seven Seas. It's great to be back. This week, we're going to dive into the world of home appliance production. We want to see who the major players are in this industry and see how the market is doing. We will also uncover some of the major contributions of the home appliance industry to the country's economy as a whole. So, let's check it out.
Our journey this time took us to Abbasabad Industrial City on the outskirts of the capital Tehran. There, we visited a company that specializes in the production of home appliances. Emerson was established some 40 years ago and has become a household name in this industry. In the early days of its activity, it started out by making freezers. Over the years, it has expanded its product list and now manufactures refrigerators, cookers, and washing machines, among a long list of other items. This company has expansive production halls, which house its chain production machinery. Each production hall is tasked with a certain process of manufacturing, such as preparing material for assembling. From start to finish, everything happens at the production lines. Having an assembly line in the manufacturing process helps keep production processes regimented. This ensures the uniform production of items. It might be interesting to know that this company uses the latest computer-assisted robotic equipment in its production halls to get the job done. Automating processes help guarantee that each step is performed with uniform standards throughout. The other advantage is it allows quality control checks and implementation of standards to be performed with speed and accuracy. An integral part of this company is its research and development department. It is strategically intertwined with the production space. Products here are randomly pulled and tested at different stages. But that's not all. This advanced department also collaborates with foreign companies in research. Its production lines produce hundreds of home appliances each day. With this in mind, it has also provided hundreds of job opportunities. The company employs expert technical engineers and experienced workers to manage designs and machines. This company has a unique outlook toward the future and is continuously looking for more ways to foster growth opportunities. As part of its future vision, it hopes to expand its reach and gain a larger share in the international market by increasing its product portfolio. Like many in the manufacturing business, the US sanctions have caused some challenges for this company. But this firm was able to turn these challenges into major opportunities for growth.
As you might know, local home appliance brands in this sector also compete with foreign ones. Iranian manufacturers produce the same quality of home appliances as their international competitors, yet many in the country still seem to be drawn to foreign names. It might be interesting to do a little price comparison here.
Iran's culture and traditions play a big role in consumer trends. For example, newlyweds are expected to move into a home fully furnished with brand new items. The budget needed to furnish a home can cost upwards of $30,000 depending on the decision to purchase foreign brands. However, the budget needed to purchase Iranian brands for ordinary items is far less. One would need a budget of around $10,000 to get it done. For example, the cost of an average two-door Iranian brand refrigerator is roughly $350. The same standard double-door refrigerator made by a Korean brand is roughly $2,500 when purchased in Iran. That is, of course, based on the daily exchange rate of 30,000 tumans to the dollar. In 2018, the government banned the import of foreign brands. Nevertheless, these brands were still seen in the domestic market. This was partly due to existing stockpiles of previous imports. The government implemented the initiative, aiming at strengthening domestic production and sales. But this gave rise to a lucrative black market of smuggled home appliances, which is still being regulated. Trafficked goods have been reduced in recent years. However, they still find their way into the domestic market.
Companies like the one we just mentioned are at the helm of this industry. Currently, there are some 80,000 home appliance manufacturing units in the country. Their domestic productions have not only helped satisfy local needs, but also saved the country millions on imports. Officials say the country is now self-sufficient in terms of the production of these items.
Iran's home appliance manufacturers were operating below their potential capacities around 2018. Before the ban on imports, some 85% of foreign brands available in the country were domestically produced under foreign licenses. The necessary infrastructure existed, but there was little domestic demand due to the competition with foreign brands. Based on figures from the Electrical, Metal and Home Appliance Office of the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, the 2018 import ban was effective. Data from the office shows last year Iran produced over 15 million home appliance units. This is 3 million units more than the government's target of last year and double the production figure of 2018. Officials with the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade say indigenizing home appliance parts has reduced imports by $500 million. Such an increase in production also means that home appliance exports skyrocketed. Last year, $140 million worth of these items were exported, and the government hopes to push this figure to $200 million this year. Some industry participants argue one way to increase quality and expand Iran's home appliance market is by lifting the ban on imports. They say the industry has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years, adding it is capable of growing stronger through serious local and international competition. Others argue that it's too soon to lift the ban, as more steps need to be taken to strengthen domestic infrastructure for manufacturing home appliances.
Historically, universities were created to satisfy a thirst for knowledge. All over the world, rulers established knowledge academies for society to benefit from scholarly expertise generated in these institutions. And now, universities have an innate discovery. Their professors write leading research, and their scientific breakthroughs have revolutionized industries. Universities have contributed to health and medicine, which has sometimes literally stopped epidemics and saved lives.
With this in mind, and universities would make for excellent...
Welcome to another edition of Supports the Development. See why research is so important in the growth of industries. Stay with us as we uncover how the higher education system is contributing to the expansion of the national economy.
To get more insight on how universities support development of technology, we visited one in the capital city, Tehran. Islamic Azad University, Northern Tehran Unit, has been around for decades. Each year, some 40,000 students matriculate in bachelor's, master's and PhD programs. Academia shares the entrepreneurial drive for discovery and innovation. So, this university adopted a program for the development of technology and engineering, which is called the Roche Center. It is a growth center that manages and operates dozens of academic incubators. The program not only supports student innovation and entrepreneurship, but also provides services to knowledge-based companies for research and development. This platform receives support and oversight from the Ministry of Science, Research and Technology and the National Innovation Fund. The main goal in developing this program is to find technological solutions for various needs of the country. For example, the outcome of a research project conducted here was the formulation of a medicine used to treat COVID-19 infections. There are 40 core projects currently in incubation here, and the center has collaborations in many fields of the industry. It is able to stay present in innovative technology arenas by directly using academic research and potentials of its students.
Now, the advantage of growth programs, such as the one we just mentioned, is that it creates a network between students, research and knowledge-based firms. Most essentially, it joins the puzzle pieces of knowledge, tools and funds together needed for manufacturing innovative products. This helps create new and advanced products that might not exist in the market or need to be further developed for industries.
The center offers important facilities for scientific studies. It houses a large and highly equipped laboratory complex for advanced research. The lab provides services and equipment to 6 departments at the university, such as biochemistry and biology. The lab complex has many functions. One is to provide research facilities to students in master's and PhD programs in various sciences. Here, students who have graduated are also employed to conduct research brought in from outside knowledge-based companies. The other function of the lab is to provide a constructive link between university research and industries. For example, knowledge-based companies that produce pharmaceuticals can conduct their research and development at the highly equipped workshops. Research at this lab has helped companies produce many vital products that were previously imported. It might be interesting to know that researchers here adhere to strict national and international standards for product quality and safety. This is a critical step for startups or knowledge-based companies who want to commercialize products they have developed. This center was developed in response to the US sanctions. It has manufactured several products and advanced technology to satisfy the needs of Iranians during the period of sanctions. Some of these products are widely used in the medical sector.
Each university in the country has a growth program that supports the entrepreneurship and innovation of students and some businesses. These centers transform creativity and scientific research into products available in the market. In a nutshell, academic incubators are one of the tools used for economic growth. So, what is the government doing to strengthen research and expand the knowledge-based economy?
In 2016, Iran had 5 times more higher education centers than most developed countries in the world. At that time, there were some 2,640 higher education centers combined. By comparison, this number was just 40 units less than China, which is the most populous country in the world. That's all according to the Ministry of Science, Research and Technology. The ministry began implementing a nationwide plan to reorganize and aggregate higher education centers last year. Under this plan, small-scale academic establishments are aggregated into a network and operated under the auspices of major universities. This saves the country millions of dollars, and educational institutions are able to share financial and educational resources. This scheme carries many benefits. First, it helps academic institutions increase the quality of education and expand the reach of academic incubators. And second, it helps the government and higher education centers efficiently allocate funds and resources to develop focused programs for research. R&D funding is also an investment in regional innovation ecosystems that leads to advanced technology production needed in industries. There are around 3.5 million students in Iran, and increasing the number of graduates has an overall positive effect on high-tech employment in the long run.
Universities play an important role in determining a region's capacity for innovation and transforming new ideas into economic activity. They educate the local workforce, which creates human capital and produces intellectual property. Universities also indirectly contribute through their research activities, which other businesses can use to make commercial value. These foundational research activities help create and advance industries in many ways.
For example, the medical sector is one that has greatly benefited from advanced technology developed by universities and research-based firms. 56% of medical equipment available in the world market in 2018 had Iranian versions. That was based on figures from the National Medical Device Directorate. Some of these items were also on the US sanctions list. These products were developed domestically and produced along the lines of international standards, allowing them to compete in markets abroad. Another advantage of indigenizing advanced medical equipment was reducing costs and dependence on imports. Based on the National Medical Device Directorate, Iran currently exports its medical products to 54 countries across the world. In 2018, the domestic market for these items was estimated to be worth nearly $3 billion.
Okay, I believe it's time for me to take a break and pass the show over to my good friend and colleague out there on the field.
Hello, everyone. We are at Inatex International Innovation and Technology Exhibition. Why are we here? Well, this is a perfect place for different businesses and entrepreneurs to promote what they do and their businesses and to find investors. So let's dive in and find out more.
Focusing on science, technology and innovation ecosystems, the International Innovation and Technology Exhibition is the meeting point of businessmen, technologists, industrialists and researchers of different countries, held not only to introduce products and form partnerships, but also to provide various insights on the latest global competitive pricing, quality standards, developments, scientific findings and economic technological ideas. In addition to introducing state-of-the-art technologies to large and medium industries, this event tries to connect customers of technology products with their respective manufacturers and offer investment opportunities to investors of technology and startups.
Among all companies that are active here in this event, we have found one which has done an exemplary activity, and that is supporting smaller local businesses in their province, and that is Rafsanjan Sarchishme Copper Company. Some 400 companies are in this exhibition. Now, in addition to normal products that you can find out everywhere, they have got some sorts of applications.
Oh.
addition to their exhibition in this innovation park, they also have different events, like different companies and entrepreneurs can present and promote their products in order to show themselves and to attract investors. That's something amazing.
This exhibition has hosted the most significant players in the innovation and technology ecosystem over the years. This stage is not limited to a specific area of technology and innovation, but rather aims to increase the synergy of technology experts and entrepreneurs coming into contact. Therefore, the latest innovation and technology trends are reviewed at this event every year. Things such as metaverse, metadata, Internet of Things, physics, cloud computing, and blockchain.
Okay, I guess that's the end of today's show. Today, for the first time, I visited an exhibition like this, a place for different businesses, companies, and entrepreneurs to see one another and to find a way to cooperate. And that's the specific feature of this event. Thank you.
Many thanks for that awesome report. There is so much more that can be said about the home appliance industry and its related trades, so let's check out some news and trends in this sector. The country is keen to bolster and further develop the home appliance sector, so it has launched a new innovation center that focuses on making products needed in this industry.
Some of the products being developed here include inverter compressors and other integrated products using artificial intelligence and electronics, among others. The center also will use nanoscience knowledge to create a new range of smart and technological products. The goal is to complement the tech ecosystem by providing a space where knowledge-based companies and startups carry out concentrated activities. It is also meant to indigenize products for domestic needs and exports.
Iran's home appliance market is worth roughly $6 billion per year, but industry participants say 40% of this market is dominated by contraband. So, how has the government responded to this issue?
The government has carried out several schemes to combat this problem with heavier regulation. One step was to implement an ID program for all home appliances being sold. Another was the closure of over 300 websites offering smuggled goods. In June 2020, the first phase of the National Anti-Smuggling Plan was implemented. The Association of Industry of Household Appliances says such initiatives have reduced the number of smuggled goods to nearly $900 million. That's in contrast to the year before, when some $2 billion worth of trafficked goods were traded.
Well, that wraps up our program for today. Don't forget to leave us your feedback. On behalf of the entire team, thank you for tuning in.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. So far in everything that we have gone through in this simple book, very valuable book as well, is that we can live in anywhere, any part of the world, and uphold our religious values without compromising, and also be successful in coexisting with others and not forfeiting anything as far as our belief system is concerned. Without doubt, we do understand that animals themselves, who have been created by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, have a benefit, and they weren't created for out of vanity or for no reason. And this benefit goes back not only to nature itself, but also to us human beings. There is misuse towards animals, and of course, dhulm and oppression can be perpetrated onto animals, and Islam also has a lot to say about that. Islam says that you're able to use animals for security, you're able to use animals for cultivation, you know, and these are among the many ni'mas of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. As far as cattle is concerned, as far as birds are concerned, as far as beehiving is concerned, you know, these are also things that have been mentioned in the Quran. You know, the Quran has also mentioned numerous surahs giving the title of that surah the name of a certain animal. Al-Baqarah, Al-An'am, Baqarah is the largest surah in the Quran. Al-An'am, Al-Nahl, for example, you know, so on and so forth. And they give us that kind of financials. They're also able to give us that kind of financial security and support, if we could say, millions of families around the world at that time, and also today as well. So giving us that need to survival and in any kind of form of entertainment. And I think it's important for us to mention what kind of entertainment. I am going to discuss that, but things like, you know, camel riding or horse riding or things like that. You know, maybe in today's society, zoos as well, you know, or circuses. Although this is my personal opinion, you know, a zoo needs to be made in such a way where it doesn't put that strenuous pressure on the animal and turn that cage into a prison for the animal. So zookeeping or putting animals behind cages in such a way that is detrimental to the animal itself is also considered to be a kind of vulm as well. And so that's why, you know, open range zoos and animal farms and things like that, for the sake of education, for the sake of kids and adults going and meeting animals up close and personal, is a good thing, as long as, you know, there are certain conditions met.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
There are many lessons
of the book
by those prophets. And
eat, take some in your hand, and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
In any case, whether it does come to nurturing of animals and breeding animals and benefiting from animals, land animals, sea animals, and also, you know, having cures from animals as well. Of course, we don't believe in using them as lab testing, for example, if not necessary for the sake of cosmetics, unfortunately, which is what some of these major brands do these days. But whatever the case may be, you know, there needs to be some kind of regulation as far as usage of animals are concerned. And, you know, until today, we are able to see how useful animals were. You know, large animals, you know, elephants, you know, and even using elephants in, for example, for armies, for battles and things like that, as we said, as far as defense is concerned, even for clothing, you know, with silkworms. Until today, we are able to find traces of usage of clothes made from silk. Of course, that meant that, you know, there were silkworm farms cultivating silk for the sake of using them to make clothes and other important items for human usage. Yes, when we do come across the surahs from the Holy Quran that have the title of an animal, Suratul Fil, Suratul Nahl, Suratul Baqarah, Suratul Ankabut, Suratul Naml, Suratul An'am, this kind of hints to us that there is a close connection, a close tie between us, the human beings, and animals. Now we understand that also in fiqh there are many ahkam related to animals, not only what is halal to eat, what is haram to eat, what is mustahab to eat, what is makruh to eat, but also issues to do with behavior, how we conduct ourselves with animals, how we treat animals, how we deal with animals, how we are able to use animals in the halal way, in the haram way, but also when it comes to important things like hunting and things like that. Now, we know that when it comes to the topic of dhabh and the slaughtering of animals, Islam has a lot to say about that. And I think this is another very kind of controversial topic that my brothers and sisters need to get into. What is the humane way for the killing of an animal? And is it stunning? Is it electrocuting? Is it shooting? Is it slaughtering of the four main arteries? Is it by use of an arrow? Is it by use of a bullet? Is it by use of a sharp knife? What is it, you know? And we're always coming across these, you know, these theories in today's modern society that speak about the Muslim way being the worst way, unfortunately, in some studies. In other studies, in other neutral studies, it's been proven that the most effective way for the slaughtering of an animal, for the terminating of the life of an animal in the most humane way, is the Islamic way, and it's also the healthiest way as well. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.